I'm Neil.
I'm Louise.
And I'm Ronnie.
I'm Daisy's dad.
I'm Daisy's mum.
And I'm Daisy's grandpa.
In 2018, Daisy was diagnosed with regressive autism.
She gradually lost all of her speech and began to show typical autistic traits.
She'd spin in circles, avoid eye contact, and make loud monotone noises.
This was a huge shock, as up until this point, Daisy had been speaking in 7 or 8 word sentences.
And had memorised pretty much 20 to 30 books.
Since then, we've all been on a journey of discovery.
In this podcast, we'll talk about that journey.
And explore the impact autism has had on all of us.
The lows.
And the highs. This is the story of Daisy.
And me.
Episode 5, Growing Up.
I think I'm probably not alone in saying that actually this is the one topic I've not really wanted to talk about. Would you be right?
Yes.
Because, and I've always sort of looked forward to having these chats
right
every week.
Yeah.
But I've been thinking about this topic and the fact that we've got to think about her growing up.
Yeah.
And I don't really want to.
All right, you don't want
to. I'm going to because I think it's important, but it's quite hard thinking about her growing up, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. We have talked in the past about, you know, just playing what's in front of us and sort of parking it. But you can't, especially, and let's talk about this as well, is we've seen her in a school uniform this morning.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
She's only, what, 2 weeks away?
Yeah.
Yep.
I suppose in the middle of the night, that's going through my head as well. I'm thinking about our first full day at school. But again, I would say there's the wee hurdle that there we said about, you know, maybe trying the school uniform on before.
Yeah.
She put it on this morning and she looks the spitting image of her mum.
Yeah.
Which was brilliant.
Yeah.
But she put it on, did she? She
did. I did distract her with Peppa Pig, but I've actually found it. I've had quite an emotional week this week, I think, thinking about school. And I think it really hit home seeing her in her uniform. And even the fact that it's the same uniform, same colour scheme as mine was at primary school as well. So I've actually been a little bit emotional. I think most parents are emotional when their child goes to school. But I think with Daisy even more so, because it's the end of an era, isn't it? I think as a parent for us, again, come back to that thing of we haven't got any other children. But also it's the unknown and how Daisy's going to cope in that situation and just what it's going to be like for her.
How are you going to cope with it?
Yeah.
We'll have more time.
Yes.
On our hands. It's going to be weird. I'm quite worried about how she's going to be. Because she has got so used to.
Yeah,
we're days.
Yeah, we're locked down
either here or at home with us, and it's going to be interesting just the length of the day because she's never really done that.
She's only ever had even her preschool nursery sessions were only ever 3 hours maximum. So there's so many things that are going to be interesting. So she is obviously going to the special unit, but I sort of worry about the food side of things because she eats well, but she's quite pernickety about things. I worry about the toileting side of things and how they're going to cope with that. But just her, I guess, the sort of the anger moments that she has. And we know when she's stressed, she bites herself quite hard. She's got quite a hard bite mark on her hand at the moment. And I'm scared about what she might do to herself or other people.
But I'm reassured. Yeah, and I worry about the toilet thing as well. I worry about the from the people we have talked to, how things build up.
Yeah.
And on a good day, she probably copes better. It's the bad days. Mm. However, she's got her teacher she had in the nursery.
Her TA, yeah.
And she's moving up with her, which is fantastic. And she's got a great relationship. And you know as well, Neil, that, you know, Daisy was shoving you out the school so she could get in to be part of the school. And you forget that as well, that even though she's autistic, she will like that. She must like the environment.
Yeah. And it's a familiar environment. It's not a brand new school. It's where she was going to preschool. So she is familiar with it and obviously with her TA, which I think is definitely reassuring. But it was funny, I spoke to Mum this morning and she was saying, we don't know what she's going to be like. It may actually be the making of her going to school. She might be so tired that she sleeps, which will help her development, but also the actual being around other children, the learning. And I do have a lot of faith in that unit. It is only sort of a couple of years that she'll be able to go there, but it might well be an amazing thing for her. Yeah. And she might just take it in her stride. So it's just there's a bit of apprehension and a bit of sadness, I think, for me.
I think every parent gets it, autism or not. It's just...
Listen, I can still remember with you dropping you off at school and nursery. I took you up to nursery and I'd take you around and I'd leave you there and you'd be clinging to my leg. It'd just be like a limp on my leg. And the lovely nursery teacher Bev would take you off, right? Say, right, he's fine, Ronnie. By the way, when you go, have a look inside the window. Just have a look in the window. I would look inside, and the little so and so is playing quite happily. And that happened. It was, you know, I was really dreading every morning to see what kind of thing. And then he just got on with it.
I started the mind games early, didn't I?
But that was secondary school. So
no, I think yeah. So parents do get it more generally anyway. But I just think the fact that she's going into what's called an infant assessment unit, which is a halfway house between mainstream and special needs, school. I'm worried about, because I know that some of the other kids in there don't communicate as well, which is sort of good. But what impact being around other kids who are sort of verbal and different variations of special needs.
Yeah.
I worry about how she's going to cope with that because it will be a more, it'll be a completely different environment to
where she was at, where she in was preschool. Before. Yeah.
1, 2, 1.
What have you had for your lunch? Did you have soup? Have you finished your soup? Was it tasty? Was it tasty?
Delicious. Oh, goody.
Is it tasty? Is it delicious? Is it delicious? Is it yummy soup? What is it, Daisy?
Delicious.
I'm glad you approve.
I'm delicious.
But on the other hand, she might find that she recognises in other children some of the things that she experiences, even at this young age. So there could also be a positive aspect to it. Well, look at it.
We had our first get-together as a family last Sunday. And so Daisy hadn't seen her cousins for ages. Instantly she knew, and we'll talk about this later on, but she just made eye contact with Libby, my oldest granddaughter, and Libby was great with her. And there was eye contact, there was excitement.
Yeah.
The other thing that reassured me, Lou, and I don't know how this will work at school, is when it became too much and we were having a party, it was a party, she decided she wanted to come upstairs.
She took herself away.
Yeah.
So she knows how to regulate herself, and I think that's really important. So that's the other thing I just hope, and I think they will cater for that in that environment, because she is going to need to find ways of regulating so that she can function in daily life. So I think, and she does seem to know how to do that. So
I think the overarching thing that the school has brought about is you do start to navel gaze. You start to think about the next years. And I suppose even if we think about, you know, the next 3 years, we know that we've got to make a decision
as to whether it's a special school or mainstream. And that's a really big decision to make. And I think it's one I've sort of thought about a lot, but I think we're almost just going to have to wait and see how she gets on, where she is.
Yeah.
There's a real mix.
But I also think as well, as we have seen a difference over the last 6 months.
Yeah, we have.
We have, in terms of her engagement, in terms of her laughing and everything and taking part in things. So, you know, 6 months and there's a difference.
Yeah.
And I don't know, will maturity bring a bit more on as well when she realises she's in this world?
I think the other thing as well I think I've sort of been thinking about is it's the not quite knowing what she's going to be doing at school and how we can help her. So when your children go to school, what I would imagine, it's funny, Mum sent me a picture of me in my school uniform at that age.
Spitting image. Yeah. I said when I saw the picture, I thought, she's done well to get Daisy to stand against that door for so long, but it was you.
Yeah, but it was funny because I sort of said to Neil, I have to be a bit careful talking about this because I might get a bit emotional, but when I saw that picture, I just started to feel really tearful because I really liked school and I was really good at, well, I was fairly good at school. And I was sort of imagining all the things that Daisy might be doing when she goes to school and the things I'd be helping, like with her handwriting. But none of those things are really, they're not really important at the moment for her. It's about her development and her social communication. So I sort of have a bit of sadness, but also a bit of, oh my goodness, what's she going to be learning? How are we going to help her with those things? And it's just, I don't know, I feel quite emotional about it all at the moment, if I'm being honest, but yeah, I shall let you speak now.
Well, it is tough.
Yeah.
One of the things I sort of wished for and may come in the future, but we don't know, is the what did you do at school today? And at the moment we can't do that.
There
may be a way to communicate with her to do that, but like you said, we don't know what she's going to be actually learning, and also the barrier of
but also the whole friendship thing. So you sort of imagine who did you play with today, or even when you hear like sort of Libby and niece, you sort of talk about at that age, or they've got a boyfriend and things like that.
Yeah.
I know it sounds really silly,
I
just can't quite. And the weird thing is,
that
we
wouldn't
did
be an issue anyway. She's not
well, yeah, that was going to, I was going to cut that off at the pass anyway. But none of my granddaughters are getting married.
Oh, that's it. But yeah, it just, I don't know, it's just that sort of hearing back about how their day has been, and we're not going to, it's just going to be different. It's going to be a different process, I think.
We've got an interview coming up with Sienna today, which is really interesting because she was talking about friendship and the fact that somebody asked her if she, you know, they could be a friend.
Mm.
And she went, no. And I thought, well, that's, you know, it's too on the nose, and I wonder whether that's maybe the way that autistic children just go, okay, I'm going to be selective.
Yeah.
You might not even know you're my friend, but you are.
She talks about it in her book about growing up autistic and sort of being awesome. And she says that she said no to that, to the friend request, just because she didn't see the value of having friends.
Right.
And then once she learnt the value of having friends in terms of kind of, you know, social interaction and sort of getting in with the right crowds and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
She started to say yes to people, but she actually found that they were the right kinds of people as well.
Yeah.
And they did. She's got to find the right kind of friends.
Do you think the two of you, because I'm pessimistic at the best of times, I'm Scottish.
Yeah.
But do you think the two of you are maybe not highlighting what could be positives?
Mm.
That we will see a big development.
Yeah.
We'll see a change in her.
Yeah.
We'll see her really, because we'll know if she's not keen on school. We'll know. She'll let us know.
Definitely.
But if, just imagine that she is excited to get her uniform on and be, and sort of after Christmas, we're talking about, my goodness, the difference. So
I do think about that. I think at the moment it's probably all just wrapped up with my maternal emotions on the whole sort of school, starting school process maybe. But yeah, I do think about
it's,
that.
It's a really tough one because I think you're right. You do naturally, it's a British thing probably, you do naturally go towards the worst case scenario, what's going to happen. But you're right, we probably should look at more of the positives.
Because we don't know, do we? And it could be amazing.
It's very hard to do that. But I think there's something to kind of cling on to in the sense that even because we've worked in incrementals in the past. We talk about the wee things, eye contact, wanting some music. The way she works that book now, you know, it's just fantastic.
Yeah.
And we sometimes forget these wee incrementals. They're not the same as maybe learning how to write.
But
for us, with Daisy just getting these wee things and us just jumping for joy.
Yeah.
Well, that's the interesting thing about the lockdown period is because we didn't see lots of people for however long. I mean, you noticed the difference because, you know, after the 3 months... You saw her again and you know, there was a big difference. But because you're there every day, you don't necessarily
see all of those little developments, little do you?
I want to talk briefly about Wills.
Oh, cool.
Just to bring the tone up.
Oh, my God.
Because it forced us to think about Daisy growing up. So we haven't got a... Well, we didn't have a Will. Actually, you didn't have a Will either until I forced you to.
You're just protecting your investment. Though.
Yeah. What investment?
Good point.
But it's interesting because... When we were speaking to the solicitor, he brought up all sorts of things you don't expect because we don't know how Daisy's going to be in years to come. And so we're looking at setting up a trust, aren't we?
Disability trust for her. So
right. What does that mean?
So it basically means that if we go, all of our assets are tied up in a trust, which you and Lou's mum and dad are the guardians of,
right?
Which means that, you know... She wouldn't have, however, you know, that a house worth of money in her bank account, which she can just go and
That's for her care then.
And
it obviously, if she then becomes independent and is able to manage her finances, then it's also would be for her. And if she marries, it's quite a complex thing. But actually, it's sort of made us really think about. So it was quite hard thinking about it. But I think we had to do it.
Thinking about death at the best of times. But I don't mind talking about my own death. It's just everyone else. No one else can die. Just I can die. It's fine. But I'm not planning to. But what's weird is I think that's been hanging over us for past few sort of weeks and months as well. And it puts your mind into all sorts of scenarios in the future. And I think that's partly why we've been navel-gazing a bit.
I think as well as you realise, I think psychologically the lockdown and COVID-19 has made everybody think about tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah,
they've all gone. We're all talking about, well, you don't know when it's, you know, you could catch it.
Mm.
And I think everybody's doing more of that now. I would imagine the will industry has got really busy because people have realised it doesn't always go on the way you thought it was going to go on. You know, you get some other diseases or, you know, heart problems, but you get this thing and it can kill you. But again, I'm pleased that you've actually done that, but I just want you to, if you can just start to part that again. Sorry, I sound like a psychologist, but I don't mean to. But because, you know, from all the things we've talked about today, you've been saying about, you know, you're worrying about, you know, the end of this period of thing. Maybe we just need to really knuckle down and just say, right, we've done The will's done.
Yeah.
Everything's in place. The uniforms are bought. Let's get her to school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see how it develops. And, you know, we could, I'm optimistic. I really am optimistic now. I've been really encouraged. Again, I'm going to get emotional. I've seen a difference. I've seen her, the way she communicates in her own way. And again, go back to that very first podcast. We're growing up with her.
Yeah.
She's teaching us how that she wants us to communicate with her.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. You know, it's just amazing. And then to see her engaged now before, because we both know, well, three of us know, very often there was no contact, no eye contact. Yeah. It was terrible.
Yeah.
You just felt that you were just some kind of accessory to her.
I think this might have been something that Mum said to me once, is that there was a spell when she had her regression and in the time afterwards where you could be in a room with Daisy and feel completely invisible.
Yeah.
And that is a really strange feeling. So the fact that we've come on so far from there, it's only got to be positive. And if that continues in that way, then, yeah, the world is her oyster, I
mean,
I guess.
To be fair, it's more of a choice now. They can make you feel invisible.
She chooses to. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But it's a wee things like, you know, when she wants to go upstairs and she does her mother's thing of carrying the iPad, an apple and a drink at the same time.
Yeah. And the kitchen sink.
And she wants to go upstairs. And I was sitting on the couch and she just went to the door and looked at me and gazed my eyes and went, I'm going upstairs. What are you doing? I'm waiting for you to say something. Well, I'm going. But it's you know, that kind of moment of clarity. Is what is
she has thing. Come an awful long way in the last 3 years.
Yeah.
Mm. And I suppose going back to what you were saying, there's optimism in there.
Yeah.
In how far she's come.
And we have to remember, I know she's starting school and she's looking really grown up, but she's still a little girl. She's still a very small child who has lots of growing and developing to
lots of potential.
Yeah.
That's, I think we've really got to go, all right.
Yeah.
Let's see and what she can achieve.
Are you going to say happy birthday, Grandad? Say happy birthday, Grandad. Good girl. Well done.
We've got a great interview today with
Sienna Castellon.
We talked to her earlier a couple of weeks ago, and she's
17 now, and she was diagnosed. I think she was about 12 or 13 when she was diagnosed. And she has become since sort of an autism campaigner. She runs a thing called Quantum Leap Mentoring, which she mentors young kids who've got autism. She's very good on the prevalence of autism in girls, and she likes to raise awareness of that. But she's published a book, How to Grow Up Awesome and Autistic, and she's met the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and BBC
Incredible
Radio
girl.
1 teen hero. But she's fantastic.
Here she is, Sienna.
Sienna, you do a lot of work with particularly young girls who are on the autistic spectrum. Can you just tell us a little bit about your experience growing up?
Yeah, so I'm autistic, dyslexic, dyspraxic, and I also have ADHD. And so all of those differences impact me. But my autism is the one that kind of impacts me the most. And actually, I would say impacts me the most in a positive way. I was diagnosed when I was 12. It was a bit of a roundabout way that I got diagnosed. I came from a family where they were all neurotypical. And so my mom had this idea that autism was more of a like Rain Man. And so she didn't think that I could be autistic because it didn't fit in with her idea of what autism was, because she wasn't really educated in neurodiversity. And so when I was growing up, I had a sensory processing disorder, and I would get very upset if noises were loud, if the lights were too bright. I had a real problem with my school uniform. I remember every morning she would try to put me into this scratchy cardigan, and it would just, like, I would cry every single morning over this cardigan. And then I would take the cardigan off when I got to school, and I would get shouted at for it by the teacher. And I wasn't able to communicate why I found it so uncomfortable. And teachers would say to me, well, like, nobody likes to wear a uniform, so why do you think that you're going to get this exception? And I wasn't able to explain it. And so I spent years having like panic attacks and crying over this cardigan, which sounds really, it sounds really petty, but at the time it really took up my school experience. I remember I had to take a test. And the whole time I was taking the test, I was just thinking about how scratchy the cardigan was. And I couldn't even read what was in front of me. And it was just the whole focus. And then when I failed it, I tried to explain to my teacher that I failed the test because my cardigan was scratchy. And she had no patience for it. She just thought I was being a drama queen. And that was what I was told when I was younger. Everyone would tell me, you're a drama queen, because, you know, I would be in sport and maybe a ball would hit me and I would start crying over it. And they'd be like, you need to be more resilient. And eventually my mom was like, I think that there might be something wrong here. And so she took me to a pain management specialist. And the specialist was like, yeah, you do definitely have a sensory processing disorder. And while we were there, I was telling him about how I was being bullied at school and how people were calling me, you know, a weirdo and a freak, because he asked me if I had any anxiety. And so I was telling him about that. And he said, you know, I think that you might be autistic. There are a lot of people who have a sensory processing disorder and are autistic. And from what you're talking about, I think that maybe there could be something there. And so I remember when I heard that, I was like, I don't think so, because I had a different idea of what autism was. I thought autism was more the male stereotype, and I presented slightly differently. And so I remember I went home and I looked at, you know, symptoms of autism, and then I looked at symptoms of girls with autism, and I was able to check every single one of them off. And I remember I would read stories about people who had the same problems that I was having. Like, I thought that I was really unique in this whole cardigan issue. I thought I was really unique in a lot of issues. And then I would read stories where people were saying pretty much the exact same thing, having the exact same experience. And so I felt, you know, part of a community. And I felt like, instead of being just so alone in what I was experiencing, there were people who could relate to me. And I ended up getting diagnosed, and it really changed my life.
Sienna, I want to go back to the topic of clothes. Daisy, if she doesn't get the right clothes for the day, she gets upset. And there's other wee things that can really annoy her. For instance, I tucked the inside of her trousers into her socks, and she wasn't happy. And what I wanted to ask you is, what is she processing like that? Because it became a big thing. She wanted it right. She's aware of these little small details.
It felt like someone had those, like, you know when you go onto a construction site and they have those machines that you put? It felt like someone was doing that to, like, my spine. And it was all I could think about. And I remember, you know, I had a similar thing with Daisy. My mom would send me to these summer camps, and I would go, and it would be, some of them were in America. And I remember one summer camp I went to, it was in California. And it was in summer, it was incredibly hot. And I said, I have to wear jeans. I cannot wear shorts. I have to wear jeans when I go to this summer camp. And so she picked me up, and it was like crazy. I think it was 100 degrees Fahrenheit. It was insane. It was the kind of heat where you could crack an egg on the pavement and it would cook. And I was wearing a jumper like this and jeans. And everyone thought I was insane. And my mom was like, what are you doing? Because I don't understand this. Like, isn't it more uncomfortable to be in jeans in this heat? And I said to her, like, it's just because I can't feel the wind on my leg. That's what's happening. I cannot feel the wind on my leg. And I remember she thought it was really weird, because around the house, I would wear shorts. Around the house, I was fine. But I would have to wear jeans in no matter what temperature if I went outside. And it seems really weird. And I remember, like, trying to explain it to people. I know that it sounds weird, but it's just how I perceive it.
The other thing we've noticed as well, Sienna, is that when we are out with Daisy and she's actually having a really good time, and then it gets breezy. And I'm not talking a massive wind here, but it suddenly gets breezy. And you can see her anxiety go up a notch when this is happening. And it seems like she just wants to get away from this breeze. So I suppose she's processing this extra thing into her experience at that moment.
No, I mean, I remember there was one time where I was being bullied at school. And my mom picked me up. And I was telling her about my day, and I told her how these people were calling me terrible names and how I didn't have anyone to sit with at lunch. And she thought, like, that's probably the worst part of your day. And then I said, but there was one thing that was just truly awful. And she was like, what is that? And I was like, the light bulb flickered in class. And I went on to tell her that I didn't care that I had no one to sit with, that I didn't care that people were calling me these, like, terrible names. I was just so focused on the fact that the light bulb flickered in class, and that was the worst part of my day, this flickering light bulb. And it's really hard to explain, because to other people that seems kind of something they would barely notice. But for me, there's an extreme to it. Like, the way to ruin my day is to have, you know, to be in crowded places, for it to be very loud. I mean, I'm very strong, you know, emotionally, so I can take a lot of bullying. I can take a lot of that because I'm so resilient and used to it. But I'm not resilient to like loud sounds and all of that. That's the stuff that my day really hinges on.
How much, it's so funny when you said about the wind, straight away I was just, Daisy's exactly the same. And in a weird way, I don't like the wind either. It sort of makes me feel quite anxious and puts me out of control and stuff. But how much effort for you goes into trying not to let that feeling of the sensory processing get on top of you? Do you have to really kind of work to almost push that back down, or how do you deal with it?
When I was younger, it was incredibly difficult. And it was the kind of situation where, you know, I find myself in similar situations. Like, I used to live in London. I found myself going on the tube very regularly. And when I was younger, it was really incredibly difficult. And when I was 17 going on the tube, it wasn't as big a problem. I mean, I still didn't enjoy it, but it wasn't as big a problem. And I remember sitting down and trying to figure out why that was. And to me, what it really hinges on is whether I have the opportunity to not be involved in that event or not be involved in doing that thing. So when I was younger, if you're in class and there's a flickering light bulb, you can't really leave. You can't just get up and be like, I'm going home now. You have to just sit there and deal with it. But when you're older, you have the option to. So I was at an event for neurodiversity. And at the event, they had different colored lights. They had like red lights, and then lights would like spin, and so you would see them all over the room, and they had these patterns, and they had some lasers, and it was just very inappropriate for an event that was trying to support people with neurodiversity. I don't really know why they decided to have those bright lights, especially since they knew that a lot of autistic people would be there. But I remember I started to get into a bit of a panic, and then I said to myself, you can just leave if you want to. And then automatically that panic just went down a bit, because I felt like I have the option to leave. I'm no longer freaking out about how I'm going to master panic attack. I'm no longer freaking out about how I'm going to last 20 minutes longer. All I'm thinking about is this moment, because I know that if it gets worse, I'm just going to pick up my stuff and leave. And when it did get really bad, that's what I did. I just got up and I left. And it didn't ruin my day. Like, before, a flickering light bulb would ruin my day. I was in this incredible, like, it was basically a light show of sorts. And I came home and I had a really nice evening, because I felt in control. And that's the really important thing. When I was diagnosed and I was able to tell people how I was feeling, and my parents were able to be like, okay, this isn't you just being a drama queen. There's something behind this. You know, if I was in a restaurant and it was too loud, we would get up and leave. And I knew that I had that option of saying to my mom, I don't want to be here anymore. And she would accommodate that. And it meant that my anxiety got a lot better. And my anxiety is linked to my sensory processing disorder. So if I have high anxiety, my sensory processing disorder is heightened. And so then I became less sensitive to sounds and all that, because I wasn't as anxious. And then my life just became so much better. So I would say it's a mix of just getting older, and it's a mix of just being more independent and being able to just leave and not having to put up with stuff that make you really, really uncomfortable. Because, I mean, you wouldn't ask a neurotypical person to do that, to be like, yeah, stay in this situation that is going to give you a panic attack. That seems like really cruel.
Yeah.
But if you're autistic, that's like commonplace. Like, teachers would tell me, you know, I know that you're going to have this massive freak out over this thing we're going to ask you to do, but you have to do it anyway.
See, I don't know, there's more support around for families and parents of children with autism. But your website, Quantum Leap, is actually geared up to people who are autistic. Tell me a wee bit more about why you decided to get this website so focused on people with autism.
Yeah, so I remember when I was first diagnosed, I started linking the fact that I was being bullied to my autism. And people would make fun of me for being weird, for being different, for being a loner. And those were all symptoms of my autism, or ways that I exhibited my autism. And so I started trying to find advice for people in my situation. And I would go online and there were hundreds of people who were saying that they were having the exact same experience as me. It is so common to be bullied and be autistic. But then when I would look for resources, it would be for the parents. And so it would be, tell your child that, you know, it's going to be okay. And I didn't know how to implement that into my life. Like, do you just say to yourself, oh, it's going to be okay? You have to have like advice set out for you. And so I remember going onto all these different forums and just trying to find little pieces of advice. And it was very difficult to do because I would have to just read through hundreds of comments, trying to find little pieces of stuff that I could implement in my life to help me. And I wasn't really able to find any, and it was very difficult. And I was also in a situation where, especially being an autistic girl, I met the first autistic girl who'd been diagnosed when I was 14. Up until that point, I had never had a conversation with another autistic girl who had been diagnosed. And so when I was 12, newly diagnosed, I had no one to talk about my autism with. And so I started just realizing that there needs to be more resources. There needs to be more tips and tricks available for autistic individuals, especially autistic girls. And so that's why I created my website, Quantum Leap.
So you mentioned there, Sienna, about the particular issue for autistic girls. And we know that they are severely underdiagnosed. Especially in this country. What do you think, having spoken to the people that you've mentored, what do you think needs to happen to make sure that parents and services feel empowered to be able to sort of go and say, do you know what, my child is autistic, but I'm going to get support and make sure that they can deal with it and become a success?
I think a lot of it is changing the diagnosis criteria. Right now, I mean, actually, when I was diagnosed, I was in bullied at the time. I had really bad mental health. And my mom was like, look, we need to get a diagnosis now if this is what you have. Because, you know, you can start getting reasonable adjustments and it'll greatly improve your life. And so she looked up CAMHS and all those NHS websites, NHS services that diagnose young people. And all of them were like, we have a 2-year waiting list. And so my mom ended up getting me diagnosed privately. And she got me diagnosed by a specialist in autism with girls. Had I not been diagnosed by a specialist in autism and girls, I wouldn't have gotten a diagnosis. I'm of the viewpoint because I don't present in the stereotypical male way. I'm very good at masking. I'm very good at picking up on other people's body language. When I was younger, I would have tantrums, but then when I got older, I would have panic attacks where nobody could see from the outside that I was distressed because I didn't show my emotions physically. And so I would just be sitting in class very still, you know, having a full-blown panic attack and nobody would know. And so from people looking in, they would think, oh, that girl's fine. That girl's not experiencing all this anxiety and she's not experiencing all these problems. And I learned to stop talking about it because people would make fun of me when I explained my sensory processing disorder. They'd call me all these names. And so I learned to just keep it all bottled up. And so had I gone to get diagnosed and had they asked my teachers if, let's say, I had a sensory processing disorder, my teachers would have said no because I knew not to go to them at that point and I knew not to talk about it. Had they asked me, oh, do you have a friendship group? I would have said yes. I did have a large group of friends. What they didn't know is that I was staying up till 2 a.m. watching TV shows and mimicking body languages. And my mom would drive me to school. And in the car, I would say, I want you to pretend to be my friend and we're going to have a conversation. And I would script these conversations and I would practice them. And then when I go to school, I'd be like social. So teachers would be like, oh, well, she's talking to that girl over there. When in reality, it was like, yeah, to talk to that girl, it took me like talking to myself in the mirror, practicing the conversation with my mom. I had a script. I was looking at all these body language. I was looking at all these films and trying to like pick apart and like writing down lines that people would say and then trying to incorporate them into my speech. And I was so good at masking that I think that most of my teachers would have said I was neurotypical. And had I been diagnosed using the male stereotype, it wouldn't have happened. But when I was diagnosed by a specialist in autism with girls, she asked me about my masking. And she asked me what I would be like if I didn't feel like I had to pretend to be neurotypical. And then that's when it all kind of came out. And that's when she's like, yeah, there's you're autistic. So I think that a big part of it is being more open to the fact that a lot of girls mask, and that just because you're able to have a conversation, just because you're able to make eye contact — that was another thing, it took me years to make eye contact — but just because you're able to, it doesn't mean that you're not autistic.
I suppose one of our biggest concerns is whether Daisy will develop the capacity to make real friends, to find another pal that she can relate to. The people you mentor, is that an issue for them? Do they struggle with forming real friendships?
Yeah, that's a fear among autistic individuals, finding someone to socialise with and finding a friendship group who understands you. I remember my mom told me this story that I was able to really relate to, but in a slightly different way. She told me that one day she went to a coffee morning with all the parents of the kids in my year group. And they were talking about their children, and they were all like, oh yeah, my day is just so terrible because, you know, Johnny spilled some like chocolate milk on the carpet. And, you know, my day was just so terrible because my girl, she didn't want to wear this dress that I'd bought her from a nice store. And my mom was sitting there and she was like, well, she wasn't able to say it, but she wanted to say, you know, my day was terrible because my child couldn't sleep through the night. She had a panic attack this morning when I tried to get her in her uniform. Then she had a panic attack because someone like blew the horn while we were driving to school. And then she started crying because she knows that there's this teacher who's really mean to her. And then she was like, oh, can you pick me up from school? There was a time when my mom would sit outside school in her car. And she would be like, you know, if anything happens, you can call me. And so my mom's having to deal with all of those things. And then she has to just sit there and pretend that she has the same issues as these people with neurotypical kids. And like the worst part of her day was some chocolate milk on the carpet. Like the worst part of her day was like knocking people to sleep and then having to deal with my panic attacks and not knowing where they were coming from. And I had a similar thing because when I was at school, I just couldn't relate to the problems that my peers were having. You know, their problem, before I was diagnosed, their problems were more like, oh, you know, my mom didn't let me go to this party and all that. And then my problem was, I'm having to spend all this time socializing with people knowing it's not normal. That was something that really bothered me. The fact that I was staying up till 2 a.m. trying to memorize all this body language and scripting conversations and knowing the whole time that no one else was doing that. And knowing that there was just something, I felt like there was something wrong with me and I didn't know how I was going to be able to fix it. And I was constantly worrying about my job prospects. Now, how am I ever going to communicate with people if this is so stressful? And I remember having anxiety about people bringing up a conversation that wasn't scripted. And that would happen a lot because, you know, conversation, it changes and you can't always just have a list of topics to talk about and steer it back that way. And so I had all these fears, but I had to pretend that I was like them. And I remember there were times where they were like, oh, let's just go get ice cream after school. Let's just go on the tube. I know a really nice ice cream place. And then they're like, you cannot spring the tube on me. That takes a whole day to prepare for me. Let's go on the tube. But of course I can't say that because they're not going to like get where I'm coming from. And so I just have to do it. And eventually I got to the point where if a friendship just caused me a lot of anxiety, I wouldn't put the effort in. I'd just be like, okay, this isn't going to work out for me. Because if you were to ask me at that time, why do you have friends? I wouldn't say because I really enjoy it, because I didn't. I found it so stressful. I would say because that's what you're meant to do. That's because everyone else has friends. And so that's what I should be doing. But eventually I reached a point where I'm like, I should just do things if I enjoy them and this isn't enjoyable. And so then I reached a point in my life. My mom's fan of me because she said that at that point, the friends I had, I was better at diagnosing people with learning differences than like teachers were, because any friend I had some kind of underlying learning difference, even before they were diagnosed. Like I remember I was friends with a girl who later was diagnosed with dyspraxia and dyslexia and dyscalculia, but at the time didn't know it. And I was friends with her because she was also able to relate to some of the problems I was having. She had dyspraxia, I had dyspraxia as well. And she would just be really clumsy and people would make fun of her for it. And so she would have to like mask it in a way. And so activities that would showcase her clumsiness, she would avoid. And so she wouldn't play ball with the kids and play all the sports and the fun games that they would do. And so we were able to relate on that level and we became really close friends. And I felt like I could be myself with her because she was neurodiverse herself and kind of she was able to relate to me a bit more. And so that's kind of what I would recommend for Daisy, just trying to find people who are similar to her and who can relate.
See, the thing, and obviously you've undergone a period of time since you were 12, and I've got to say congratulations because you just got your A-level results and it was 3 A stars, am I right?
Yes.
That's fantastic. And you're a published author, BBC Radio 1 teen hero, you've got the A-levels. And when you were 12, did you think that sort of future was possible?
No, I didn't. When I was 12, I was in a really difficult situation. When I was 4, my mom took me to a child psychologist and they did an IQ test of sorts. And they said that I was gifted. And so I was actually put into a school for gifted children when I was younger. But I wasn't, it was a very big school. And my mom decided to take me out so that I could be in a smaller class size and just because she felt like that would benefit me because of my autism at the time. She didn't know I was autistic. And when I was put into this smaller school, I was automatically put in all of the bottom sets. And my mom was like, well, she just came from this gifted school and she is like a gifted child, so why is she in all the bottom steps? And teachers were like, oh, well, because she can't spell very well and because her handwriting is really messy. And at the time, that was what they considered important. And on top of it, I would invert my numbers. And so they were like, yeah, she has to be in all the bottom steps because she doesn't know how to write properly because of her spelling and the way she inverts stuff. And then for the rest of my school experience, up till I was about 8, I was just in bottom sets and teachers would tell me like, you're stupid. Teachers would tell me you're lazy, which I didn't understand because I don't know why you would spend hours writing an essay or a creative writing piece and then be lazy because you made a few spelling mistakes. Mm. You just wouldn't do it if you're lazy. Mm. But they would say all this really like derogatory stuff and really hurtful stuff. And I remember going home and asking my mom, like, am I stupid? Because teachers would say that to me. And they would say it repeatedly. And later I realized that I was actually bullied by some teachers. And when I was 12, I was just really confused because I was reading all these really advanced books and I had all these really advanced interests and I was obsessed with going to museums and I was really into like literature, but I wasn't being recognized for that. And there was a time when I'm like, I'm not even gonna graduate school because the way that I'm being, at that time, I knew I was dyslexic and dyspraxic, and the grading system was just so disadvantaging me every which way. Later, when I went on to do English language, I got an A on English language, and I got my script back, and the reason I got an A was because they graded me on spelling. And every single time that I made a spelling mistake, a mark was taken away. Mm-hmm. And had I not been dyslexic, I would have gotten an A star. And that's the kind of stuff that just adds up throughout your school experience. You know, the little tests you have to do where they just decide to mark you down. And so there was a point where I didn't feel like I would even graduate. So now I've got my A stars. And I'm really happy because teachers told me, like, you belong in the bottom set in math because I would invert my numbers. And now I have a place at Imperial to study physics. So I got in there because, like, my math skills. And I went to the number one math school in the country. And so... it's just something that amuses me now.
Sienna, as we said, you're 17. I just wanted to put this to you. Daisy's going to be 5 in September. What do you think Daisy will encounter when she's 17 and on her way in the world?
I think that the most important thing is that she feels empowered with her autism. And, you know, that's the real difference. I look at people who, you know, may be gifted, may not be, may have different interests. And what makes them successful and what makes them happy isn't those interests and those different level of intelligence. It's solely whether they accept their autism. And that's what happened with me. When I was younger, I didn't know I was autistic, but all my symptoms, I was very upset about. And I would constantly put myself down over them. And when I would stumble in a social setting, I would fixate on it. And I would, every night, I would write a list of all the things I'd done wrong that day, socially. And I would say, I have to learn from this. And I would, in a way, punish myself for, I didn't know I was autistic, but for being autistic, for all my social communicational problems I was having. And then once I was diagnosed, I'm like, well, of course I'm going to make these blunders. Of course I'm going to have social communication issues, because autism is a social communication disorder. And so it's just like, I'm not going to beat myself up for having bad spelling. This is just the way that things are going to work. And I decided to be very open about it and to just tell people, you know, I am autistic. And that way they were less likely to, you know, judge me for making certain blunders. And also I found less likely to bully me. I was still bullied for being autistic. But there were a few people along my school experience who were like, this is actually really uncool. Like, you're bullying someone for having a disability, and who stood up for me because of that. And so I would say that the real, if she's just empowered with her autism, if she's proud to be autistic, if she, you know, learns more about her autism, that's another thing. I got to a point in my life where I mapped out my day, and every day I would try to do one thing differently that would improve my experience. And so I had to walk to school, and one weekend I said, I'm going to spend this whole weekend trying to find another path to walk to school that's less crowded, because that was something that was stressing me out. And that whole weekend, I was walking around the neighborhood where my school was, trying to figure out like a combination of back alleys and a combination of residential areas to get to school. And I finally figured it out. And I did that at the beginning of the year. And then each day that I went into school, I was more calm. I was more relaxed because I hadn't been through this crowded area. And it meant that, to be honest, I think I did better on my exams because of that, because I had less anxiety. And I was just generally happier. And so it's little stuff like that, like reflecting on your life, being very open about your autism and talking about it and being proud of it, that can really make someone very happy.
Well, Sienna, I've got to say, just through the process of doing this podcast, what I've found, and I know my dad's found it as well, is talking to people like you, and we spoke to Max Green, and we've spoken to parents of autistic children. It strikes me that one thing that we all need to do, whether we're someone with autism or a parent of someone who has autism, is we just need to reach out into the neurodiverse community more, because I'm learning every single time I speak to someone. And what you've told me today, you know, when it sort of makes me less anxious about Daisy becoming a teenager, which, you know, regardless of autism or not, would be, you know, challenging because she's, you know, she's a teenager. But it's so inspiring just knowing that there are almost sort of points of light to reach towards. So thank you so much for that. I don't know what you feel, Dad.
You know, Sienna, one of the greatest things that's happened during these podcasts is we're talking to people like you, and you're telling us that we should embrace Daisy's autism. It's who she is. And don't see it too much as an obstacle at this point. Just give her all the help she needs to develop and see that as a positive moving forward. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and I mean, that's why I named my book The Spectrum Girl Survival Guide, and then How to Grow Up Awesome and Autistic.
Hey, Sienna, thank you so much for joining us. Your website, Quantum Leap, is amazing. When, by the way, are you starting university?
I'm not sure right now. I'm thinking of doing a gap year, just because of all the uncertainty with COVID. But yeah, I'm still decided. But I do have a confirmed place at Imperial that I would start in September, I think.
That's fantastic. That's so fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Sienna. It's just, as I said, so inspiring speaking to neurodiverse people and learning. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And it was really great to talk to you.
listening to Sienna, I think she's just so inspiring and such an incredible girl. That was just such an interesting interview for me. And I think the thing that really stuck out was just around her, the whole friendship making thing and her choosing who she wanted to be her friends, but actually seeing in them their disabilities and seeing them as really positive things. That to me was just, I think that was just incredible. And how much she's achieved as well. Just, brilliant girl.
And she's into university now.
A slightly different story, a later diagnosis. She kind of knew something wasn't quite right. In her sort of biog on her, her mother could never quite understand why she got good reports from school, but when she came home, she was a nightmare. And that's almost like the reverse, you know, of what you would expect.
I was going to say, she talks a lot about the masking, and that's something that some of our other sort of interviewees who've had autism have actually talked about as well, just this ability to mask, and that's something particularly in girls, I think, that they do. So, but in some ways that masking, although it did have sort of detriments at times, it has actually helped her to function in life as well. So yeah, one thing that did stand out for me that worries me is the bullying aspect, because she mentioned that several times, and that's something we haven't really touched upon within the growing up bit, but that is a worry, I think.
It is, yeah.
But she coped with it in her own way. She seemed to be quite resilient.
I think I've been reading her book, and one of the standout points for me is there's this terminology of high functioning and low functioning autistic people, and she said actually that's useless, because someone might seem high functioning at the point that you're speaking to them, but then a couple of hours later they might shut down completely.
We'll be having an anxiety attack, or
and actually it sort of doesn't help
the
conversation to say that someone's high functioning, because it you almost take away what that what the autism is doing to them.
It also feeds into that sort of stereotypical language that we use in autism, and I'm guilty of it sometimes as well, but actually it's so there's so much more to it than that, than labeling, isn't there? High functioning, low functioning.
The bit that got me was how you know topical she was talking about the school uniform that you're scratching. And I was thinking, all right, when you showed me the school uniform, did you see me feeling it?
Yeah.
That's going to be all right. But, you know, because that was what annoyed her. That whole, she couldn't take her mind off during the lesson, the fact that this was scratchy. So that was going through my mind. But terrific. And her website is called Quantum Leap, and she is a great mentor as well.
Yeah.
Right, we better go. Before we go, let's do the high points of the week for Daisy. Whose turn is to go first this time?
You start.
For me, there's a couple of bits. There was a disco last week when her, you know, we get this thing where she wants the curtains closed and we've got some disco lights. And she wants to get, there's that one song, Bambolero.
Bambolero.
Bambolero. Okay, well, Bambolero.
She doesn't ice skate around the place. Bambolero.
But it's Bambolino.
Bambolero.
You can tell I'm the you can tell I'm the DJ, can't you? No, it's anyway. It's by the Gypsy Kings, and she loves this song, and I think she can talk language, foreign languages, and she loves this song to go. When Libby was around, the two of them ran up and down together to this song. And what gets me with Daisy is she waits for the chorus. She's almost kind of, here come the chorus. And she just goes straight into this running up and down, which was just ridiculous. But to see her and Libby together was fantastic.
I mine this week was when you called. So I was upstairs and you said, Neil, and I went, what? And you said, you might want to come down and see this. So I come downstairs and I walk towards the kitchen, and Lou just points at Daisy. And Daisy's been into the freezer, which she's doing at the moment because she eats ice cubes. But she's been into the freezer and she's got this massive ice cream out. It's 8:30 in the morning. She'd never opened an ice cream wrapper in her life before.
But
she did it for the first time. And we actually didn't stop her. We stood there and laughed.
Well, to be honest, she was already halfway down.
She'd most of it by then.
And then when she saw me, she carried on eating it very quickly because she knew I was going to take it away from her.
Yeah.
So mine is actually based around the Bumbaleo theme as well. So it was really funny this week because she's got this thing about turning the lights off, shutting the curtains, putting the disco light on and then running up and down. So I was in there dancing with her. Neil came down because he'd been working, came into the living room, so I took her hand and did a bit of dancing, and she got his hand, led him out of the room and shut the door behind him and then just came back in, looked up at me and put her hands up and carried on dancing. The funniest thing was, is then after that I just opened the door and then Neil was just standing there looking in with a really sad look on his face.
Actually, it may be Neil, because when he came to pick her up the other day, she came into the house and she shut the door. Which I've been trying to do for years, which is fantastic. Thank you very much for listening. You can get in touch with us via the Anchor. Leave a message on the Anchor website, or we've got the
daisyandmepodcast@gmail.com or on Twitter @daisyandmepod.
We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.